Hello.
Hey, it's Ed.
Hi, Ed. Sandra.
Hi, Sandra. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I just came back from the East Coast. Doing better.
Yeah,
The weather was terrible.
it's a little chilly today, that's for sure.
Well, it poured rain on Wednesday or Tuesday or Monday, one of those days.
Okay.
Newark Airport is a zoo.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good
Right.
to be back where it's 70 degrees and
Well, I
all
was going to say you should come visit us because it's nice and sunny, but then you said 70 degrees. I was like,
let's see, anyone else on?
Hey, Ed, it's Tom.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Doing pretty well. How about you?
Hanging in there. Just flew in from
Yeah.
the yesterday, so good to be back home.
I just flew back to DC the other day into the cold, so I don't know how good it is to be back, but
Yeah,
we're here.
I've weathered. I'm glad I left the East Coast. I'm telling you that.
Well, you were smart, and you did it a long time ago. Yeah.
Did, yeah. Since I guess I moved out here in '88, so it was a smart move.
Yeah.
Who else is on?
Hey, Ed, Bill and Dale are here.
Hello, Bill.
This is Jeff. I just joined.
Hey, Jeff.
This is Tom Blanchard, just joining. Scott's here.
Hey, Scott, are you around on
Yes.
Monday?
Yes, I'm supposed to meet with you.
You are? Awesome. What time?
Right after your seminar.
Okay, cool. I look forward to it.
In fact, I just got your itinerary a little while ago.
Awesome. Maybe you could forward it to me.
I will do that right now.
Gotcha. Okay, anyone hasn't told me they're on, who's on?
Hannigan's here.
Michael Charnas, good morning, good afternoon.
Hi, Michael.
Joanna's
Hi,
here.
Christina.
Hold on, hold on. I can't go that fast. I've got jet lag. All right, John Hannigan's there. I got John Hannigan and Charnas. Who else?
Weinberg.
Joanne.
Hello, Ed.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good.
Okay, so
And
Jennifer.
Nixon.
Oh, Sarah Jo Nixon.
Yeah. And should I be staring at anything other than a big H for Hannigan in the middle of my screen?
I don't know why that's there, but
Okay. I mean, it's attractive.
that's what I have a big H.
You mean
Perry?
me, not me.
Perry, are you on?
This is Dan. I just came on. I'm sorry, I was about a minute late.
Hi, this is Cristina de Perales here.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that last one.
This is Cristina de Perales.
Oh, gotcha, Christina.
Gotcha.
All right, so I'm looking for Jennifer Thomas.
Yep.
Christy Petranco. Claire Coles. Johan.
I'm here.
Ted Jones. Tina Chambers. Sarah Matson. Allison Noble. Mike Suddy. Kazu and Masaki.
I'm here.
Bill Barnett, Kathy Mitchell. James Reynolds.
Here.
Okay. And Terry, I didn't hear whether you were on or not.
Yep, I'm here.
Thanks, Terry. Helen? Miguel? Okay, well, give them one more minute, and then we'll get the show on the road.
Ed, this is Claire. I don't know if you heard that I was on.
I did not, Claire. Tanner, Tina, Sarah, Christy.
Yes, I'm here.
Allison or Mike. All right. Anyone else on the call? All right. Well.
Is NIAAA on?
Yep, they're there.
Okay.
They're
always.
They're everywhere, John.
Yes, I know.
Okay. Well, John Hannigan was instrumental in putting together a consortium, if you will, of the CFAS with the other centers, P grants that are doing alcohol, developmental alcohol research. And one of the things John was able to arrange was to provide, set up a WebEx so that we could start hearing about what these other centers are in fact doing in terms of developmental alcohol exposure. And so today's going to be our first WebEx by one of those presenters, and it's Terry Diak, who's the coordinator of the center director of the one at Binghamton, which is our Developmental Alcohol Exposure Research Center, or DEARC. And many of you know Linda Spear, she's the scientific director of that project, but she couldn't be on here today. Terry got his PhD at the University of Colorado, and he's interested in how psychological stress and how we adapt to that. And I've known Terry for a number of years now. And Terry, I guess we're ready anytime you are.
Well, thank you very much. Can everybody hear me okay?
And,
yes.
Yep.
And Terry, was your program just refunded?
Wow, getting right to the point. Yes, things are always uncertain until the day you get that notice of award, but things are looking very promising.
Well, the reason I brought it up is I wanted to congratulate you because I heard it did well. So.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, we are cautiously optimistic. We got pressed yesterday for the just-in-time information, and I believe that they are preparing the award notice as we speak. So kind of a dubious day for that.
Well, again, congratulations.
Thank you.
And give my best to Linda, please.
I will. I know that Linda was pretty excited to be here for this today, but just wasn't able to make it. So she sends her regards to everybody. I'm trying here to share my desktop or my PowerPoint slide with everybody.
There it is. But I just wanted to take a moment.
I just want to interrupt really quick. It sounds like someone's in a room with children. If you can mute yourself, that would be awesome.
Or mute the children.
So I wanted to just take a moment to thank John for organizing this and for inviting me to give a brief overview of the center to you guys today. I think this is really a fantastic idea. Certainly I think it's the ongoing expectation from the federal agencies that we have some talk across centers. And I think that's a great thing to do to help accelerate research progress. So really delighted to talk to you today. I'm going to give you just sort of a skim coat overview of the center. today, and you know, it's sort of an interesting in trying to put this together. You know, we're really at this transition point where the center, you know, is you know, closing up year. Well, we're in the 10th year as a center, and getting ready to pivot towards hopefully what will be another 5 years of funding as soon as we get that notice of award. So we're pretty excited about that. So it's an interesting challenge because it gives me the opportunity to talk a little bit about the past and a little bit about the future. And I'm not going to talk in detail about either one of those because I understand I have 20 minutes to talk. So just a little bit of history. I think some of you on the phone call here know the center from its inception. Certainly Joanne and Michael and Ed have been involved with the center at various capacities over the years. We were initially funded in 2009. Renewed in 2014, and we just submitted our renewal almost exactly a year ago today, which is interesting to see how far we've come in that year. The center began and continues as a regional collaboration in upstate New York. Was originally awarded to Upstate Medical University under Michael Miller's direction, and in 2010 it migrated down to Binghamton, and Linda Spear became the center director. So it's currently split between Binghamton and Upstate Medical. So we've got two investigators up there, two or three investigators up at Upstate, and the rest of the main projects and cores are located down here at Binghamton. So what it started initially as an Upstate Medical, you know, centric center, if that makes sense, has migrated more fully down to Binghamton. In the proposed renewal period that would start in September, the project will be located entirely at Binghamton, with the exception of some small pilot projects that will be located off-site. You know, as many of you know, Linda's had some health issues over the last year and a half or 2 years, and so we made the change about just a little over a year ago where we swapped positions, and she resumed her prior role as scientific director, and I took over as center director. I don't think anybody regrets that decision more than me. But we have, you know, over the years, we've really, the center has been a great incubator for bringing in new faculty. We've hired quite a few new people. I'll introduce you to those here in a moment with the next slide. But some of the hires we've had include David Jentsch, who works on the genetics of addiction. His primary research interest is in impulsivity and regulation of self-control and loss of control that occurs with chronic drug abuse. Many of you may know Marvin Diaz, who did his PhD with Brian McCool at Wake Forest, and then went on to do a postdoc with Fernando Valenzuela at University of New Mexico. We just recently, just this September, hired a Nutri Karkanis, who's interested in pharmacology and addiction, and at this point, she's just setting up her lab, so we're really enthusiastic. She comes to us from Wake Forest as well. And just to whet your appetite here, we do have a new faculty search that has opened. It was suspended for a brief amount of time because being university budgets being what they are, but it will be reopening at the end of this week, and we're looking to hire at the associate professor level. So if you know anybody who's interested in that position, please drop me a line, and I can give some more details. This is the broader group of people affiliated with the DIRC. So we've got, you know, myself and Linda and Lisa Savage and David Jentsch will be main project PIs in the renewal that will start in September. We've got quite a few faculty who serve in various capacities for the cores and as co-investigators, and people you may know, Dave Werner, Lena Berlinskaya, Sandra Mooney. Of course, Sandra's been a part of the center since its inception. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Terry.
you know, we've got our upstate folks who I got the grainiest pictures I could get of them, you know. And of course, Steve Young and Thomas moved on to University of Tennessee now. But this is sort of the core group of people who are most intimately involved in the DIRC right now. We could add in some additional people who have had pilot projects over the years. But it's quite a critical mass. The overarching goals of the DIRC, as you can imagine, are to better understand unique developmental vulnerabilities to early alcohol exposure. And a major focus of our work is, of course, to identify long-lasting consequences of early alcohol exposure that may persist or emerge across the lifespan. So this is sort of a unique feature that's emerging in the DIRC just in the last year or two, is that we're taking an increasingly lifespan perspective. This is occurred naturally as a part of a couple of the projects that were initiated as adolescent alcohol exposure, and looking at effects that persist into young adulthood. Now we're looking into late aging. So we really are becoming a lifespan center. And of course, we want to delineate the very specific mechanisms by which alcohol affects the developing brain, and so that we can also understand how these things interact with other life events, and in particular, stress challenges and other drugs of abuse that can tell us more about a multi-hit perspective on developmental effects of alcohol. And ultimately, you know, we are very much a preclinical center. We do not have a human clinical component to it, though we have had some projects that are more clinically oriented. We all work in very basic science, and hopefully the findings that come out of this will help us develop strategies for ameliorating the adverse consequences of early alcohol exposure. So I guess that there's a unique focus of the center. It's that we are not specifically focused on prenatal alcohol exposure, as you probably know. Linda Spear has sort of written the book quite literally on adolescent alcohol exposure. And so we focus on two key developmental periods and the intersection between those two developmental periods that seem to be where alcohol exposure seems to be most prevalent. Fetal alcohol exposure, of course, I don't need to tell this group very much about that. And adolescent alcohol drinking. And so it's really quite interesting to see that there are a wide variety of developmental targets, ongoing developmental changes that occur in brain that that create unique sensitivities and developmental vulnerabilities during these periods. Of course, these effects can manifest in humans and even in rodent models as fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and binge-like alcohol consumption that is prevalent even in adolescent rats. So we use, unlike a lot of centers, we use a wide variety of alcohol exposure procedures and models to more broadly capture what's happening with the developmental vulnerabilities. So we don't have a single locked model for alcohol exposure. So what you'll find here shortly is we have some people doing inhalation, lots of other things. So the historical origins of the center and what the sort of overarching theme, the biggest theme that binds us together, is this concept called the alcoholism generator. This came out of a paper that Linda and Michael wrote back in 2006 that basically argues that early alcohol exposure during the prenatal period is what helps to prime and foster further adolescent alcohol consumption, which then creates a greater likelihood of having an alcohol use disorder later in life and then perpetuating this future prenatal alcohol exposure in the offspring. This concept was described as the alcoholism generator and continues to be sort of a guiding sort of North Star for the center as we have unfolded over the last 10 years. Ultimately, the goal here is to try and disrupt this generator. So if we can find ways to block binge drinking, prevent binge drinking in adolescents. Now, the good news is that this has actually been working pretty well. The public health campaigns have led to a slight curtailment in binge alcohol consumption in recent years, over the last 10 to 15 years. Though binge alcohol consumption remains to the highest during the adolescent period. If we can break this cycle then perhaps we can minimize the number of fetuses that are exposed to alcohol and therefore prevent further binge drinking. So finding ways to break these cycles and promote escape channels for those that do engage in binge drinking, how do we find therapeutic approaches either through pharmacological means or behavioral interventions to prevent or curtail binge drinking, and closed incoming conduits. So the idea here is that there are that this alcoholism generator may be revved up, if you will, by things like major life stressors or other infections or other early life experiences that prime alcohol consumption later in life. So of course, to do this, we really have to have a comprehensive picture of what's happening developmentally in response to alcohol. We, of course, take a lifespan approach, and so what you see in our center is some studies that are longitudinal in nature, some that are cross-sectional in nature, being the good developmentalists that we are. Many of the projects use gestational alcohol exposure that is either quite discrete.
Excuse me.
or that's you know, focused on just a single day or two within early gestation, other procedures will do provide a more comprehensive exposure to alcohol. Quite a number of our projects also, you know, compare repeated binge-like alcohol exposures during adolescence. There are quite a number of projects that work on this. This is, takes the form of gavage treatment, sometimes high levels of voluntary intake, and where we look at and where projects have looked at persistent effects that last into young adulthood or to middle age. We now have projects that are extending into late aging, but unfortunately, those late aging studies, these longitudinal studies, really take a long time to unfold. And so getting from adolescent alcohol exposure into, you know, late aging requires a heck of a lot of planning. And of course, we have some cross-sectional studies that, that systematically compare different ages of animals that, so that we can better understand unique developmental sensitivities to alcohol. This just shows you here the distribution of our projects across these different approaches, and really I think creates a compelling picture that we have a really distributed viewpoint of early alcohol exposure. So we've had quite a bit of progress over the last 9 years. We've published over 125 articles already and counting as a center. So we have, you know, I think some of the core findings that really resonate with me have come out of the, you know, main project two, which is currently led by Steve Youngentob, showing that prenatal alcohol exposure increases adolescent ethanol avidity by changing the flavor qualities of ethanol. So they have decreased aversion to ethanol's bitter and oral irritation properties, and they're more likely to respond favorably to the ethanol vapor or ethanol odor later in life. So this creates an increased acceptance of alcohol after prenatal alcohol exposure. This is similar in many ways to what Linda has seen with her project, where she showed reduced sensitivity to the ethanol-induced conditioned taste aversions, and so prenatal alcohol exposed to animals when tested later in life. So they're less sensitive to the aversive properties of alcohol. And of course, you know, Lena's project in collaboration with Sandra Mooney has shown that high social anxiety among PAE-exposed offspring predicted later sensitivity to anxiolytic effects of ethanol and, of course, high ethanol consumption. So it's really been, you know, really nice work demonstrating sort of this proof of concept that for the alcoholism generator that that early alcohol exposure really does prime later ethanol acceptance. Some of the long-lasting consequences of alcohol that people are looking at come out of course, the other projects. Eric Olson's project at Upstate Medical University has been looking at cortical explants, and he's been able to show some really interesting misorientation of cortical neurons in response to ethanol exposure, and some other cellular effects, including fragmentation of Golgi, destabilized apical dendrites. He's got these really rapid phosphorylation events that are happening in cells that he's exploring now that happen on the order of 5 to 10 minutes, but then clear very quickly. That seem to be critical for this misorientation. So the rapidity of these effects is really quite amazing. What I really like about his project is that all of the effects that he's been able to show in vitro, the really big ones, are now being shown in vivo as well. So that's kind of cool too. And then from my own project, we've been focused more on less on the prenatal side of things and more on the adolescent exposure. And one of the really surprising things that we found a few years ago was this demonstration that adolescent alcohol, when adolescents are exposed to alcohol, they show a substantially impaired neuroimmune response. Their cytokine fluctuations are nowhere near as severe as what happens with adults. And it actually is, in a series of follow-up studies, what we found is that it does not seem to be something that is a property of the response to ethanol, but is a more universal effect during adolescence. So regardless of whether we challenge them with alcohol or LPS to induce cytokine expression or stress challenges, the male and female adolescents show a substantially impaired neuroimmune response relative to adults. And what's really kind of a paper we have under review right now, I think is really interesting, probably one of the more interesting papers we've had in a number of years, is showing that if you expose the adolescent animals to repeated ethanol intubations during adolescence and then test them in response to adult ethanol challenge, that they seem to show what I would describe as a severely suppressed neuroimmune response in brain, you know, through microdialysis. And so what happens here is that the animals are cannulated in adulthood, and we can measure the functional release of cytokines evoked by that microdialysis probe insertion. And when you do that, the adolescent alcohol-exposed animals display a completely flatlined neuroimmune response. Quite shocking, actually. That paper is revised and resubmitted. So the proposed project, I want to just take a moment here. I know we're on limited time. I don't want to take too long, but...
we're good, Terry. We're good. So you don't need to run.
Okay. All right. I'm speaking at the East Coast pace. So one thing I've learned from Linda is that you can get, you should, living on the East Coast, you have to double the number of words per minute. So... So I'd just like to take that gives you sort of a flavor of the kinds of things that we've been working on in recent years. And I want to just pivot now briefly and talk a little bit about where the projects are going in the renewal period. A couple of main projects will be terming, and so we have two new main projects that will be starting in the new project period. Main project one will be led by Dr. David Jentsch. And he's got a really interesting project that he's proposed using the four core genotype model. Not sure if everybody's familiar with this, but basically what they have developed, David didn't develop this, it was developed by Art Arnold, I believe, at UCLA, is a genetic manipulation which the SRY gene, which determines gonadal development towards the male phenotype, has been deleted. And so what happens is you can delete this SRY gene from XY males, and what happens is you end up with an animal that is XY or genetically male, but that develops ovaries instead of testes. So it's a way, and then they're able to use a transgene of that SRY, a transgenic animal, where they insert that SRY gene into females, where they can produce XX females that have testes. And so this creates a 2x2 matrix, if you will, where you can genetically, you can disaggregate genetic sex effects from gonadal steroid sex effects. And so he's using prenatal alcohol exposure through vapor administration and has been able to show that in his vapor model that he gets this escalation of ethanol consumption during adolescence, as a result of prenatal alcohol exposure, speaking directly to this alcoholism generator theme, and the use of the 4-4 genotype model will allow him to better understand the sex-specific outcomes and the genetic versus gonadal steroid contributions to those effects. So really kind of hot new project coming into the DIRC, which is kind of neat. Main project 4 is a continuing project that's led by Linda Spear, and has Lena Berlinskaya and Dave Warner as co-investigators, that's examining sex differences and social predictors of high ethanol drinking at adolescence, and finds, interestingly, that male rats, male adolescents, so this is really focused on adolescents, but the basic procedure here is that if you put the males and females in groups of same-sex conspecifics, what happens is that the males tend to consume more alcohol due to the social facilitation effect of alcohol. So they seem to get really excited about playing together and then drink more alcohol. The females, on the other hand, seem to drink for other purposes, which is to reduce social anxiety. So again, a really interesting project looking at sex-specific effects in alcohol consumption during adolescence. We also have a pilot project that's been proposed by Frank Middleton, which I think is a really intriguing project that is looking at prenatal alcohol exposure effects and the possibility that you can transfer the prenatal alcohol phenotype through the transfer of exosomes that are released by fetal, prenatal alcohol exposed animals through in utero transfer. Very high risk project, exactly the kind of thing that you'd want to see with some you know, for a pilot project where you can take some risks that you can't take with a standard NIH proposal. So very exciting project, also focused on prenatal alcohol exposure. Several of the other projects, including my own, is looking at long-lasting consequences of adolescent alcohol exposure. So we have Lisa Savage, who's going to be running a project that capitalizes and sort of moves forward on an R01 that she has currently funded. That's looking at remapping of septohippocampal cholinergic pathways after adolescent intermittent ethanol. And so the basic procedure here, and what the core data that she's shown and published in recent years, is that a lot of the cognitive deficits associated with chronic alcohol exposure are really a result of thiamine depletion that occurs with alcohol exposure, and that you know, these adolescent alcohol exposure effects, some of them you know, don't seem to manifest until after the rats have aged over 12 months old, and so there's this septohippocampal remapping that occurs, you know, that allows the younger animal to compensate for this loss of cholinergic function that occurs with adolescent alcohol exposure. Really interesting project, and what she's hypothesizing, and I think, you know, has really strong data to support, is that those these cholinergic neurons that which seem to have atrophied but perhaps not died, that they are rescuable with regular voluntary exercise later in life, which is kind of cool. So we're, my project, the main project three, doing this sort of out of order to try and keep them sort of conceptually oriented, we're really trying to bear down on what are the mechanisms that contribute this relative insensitivity of adolescents to the neuroimmune effect of alcohol, what are the neural circuits that are activated by these cytokines that fluctuate across the intoxication withdrawal cycle, and what are the implications for the later expression of negative affect, which we know is one of those incoming conduits into the alcoholism generator. This actually fits pretty well with a pilot project that's being proposed by Hadley Bergstrom at Vassar, that's also looking at IE effects on prefrontal cortex circuitry in extinction learning, which also has implications for negative affect. So maybe that gives you a little bit of a flavor of what we've been working on and where the projects are going. We will, of course, you know, assuming we get funded, which is, you know, looking better and better every day, we will have a pilot project program where people can apply for additional pilot projects. So right now, you know, this is sort of our summary slide. As you can imagine, this is, you know, I've done some rendering here of the presentation that I gave at the overview at a reverse site visit. But the project, you know, compared to other centers, I would say that we are bound together by a very broad principle in this alcoholism generator, which creates, you know, gives a lot of latitude to the projects to how they approach their models and their systems. And so the themes that bind us together, of course, are the developmental effects. Everybody's looking at fetal and adolescent alcohol exposures. Many of the projects are looking at the interaction between fetal and adolescent alcohol exposure, and including my own. Several of the projects are looking at negative affective consequences of chronic alcohol exposure and how those perpetuate alcohol consumption. Sex differences is a major component of all of the projects that I think will, for the first time, begin to try and dissect, you know, I'm really excited about this, being able to dissect the gonadal versus the genetic sex differences in David's project. And then, of course, we have overlaps in the circuitry that we're looking at. So this, of course, has been a bigger picture kind of presentation, but you know, there is a fair amount of circuit level work that's being done in a couple of the projects that sort of binds us all together. So these are the sort of core themes that are being addressed by DIRC faculty. So I just want to take a moment to thank everybody. Please also, we have a training grant in developmental neuroadaptations in alcohol and addiction. Please send us your trainees. We're looking for postdocs and grad students, so if you have any. I'd like to just acknowledge also our external advisory board, or what NIAAA now calls the Program Advisory Committee. Ed Riley, I think, has been on the advisory board since the DIRC's inception, as has John and Scott, and I think Susan. You know, we've got a newcomer in Adrian Harris, and Justin Chandler's on there. So great, it's been really great to have everybody's thoughtful advice. NIAAA has been surprisingly supportive. Well, I shouldn't say surprisingly. They've been very supportive, and we're grateful for that. And I just want to take a moment to, acknowledge that, a lot of the things that I've spoken about here today, are things that I have learned about largely through reading the work of Linda and Skip Spear, who sort of formed the backbone of the center in its inception. It's, particularly, disappointing that we couldn't have Linda here today, but I wanted to just give a shout out to her because she continues to be the North Star for our center as moving forward. So that's all I have.
Well, thank you very, very much, and I hope you have time for if there are any questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Terry, this is Dan Savage. Good job. 20 minutes is not much time to present such an overview. I was struck by the effect of adolescent alcohol exposure on neuroimmune responses, because I think you're aware that when there's prenatal alcohol exposure, some of the work that Aaron Milligan has been doing, they actually later in life have heightened neuroimmune responses. And I got to wondering what might happen if animals that were prenatally exposed were subsequently exposed again as adolescents, how the prenatal exposure might impact that flat neuroimmune response during adolescence. I mean, I think that's a real-life scenario that probably happens, and how would earlier exposure impact your adolescent exposure?
That's a great question, Dan, and I'm glad you asked that. We have a series of studies that we're writing up right now that asks exactly that same question. So we in this set of studies, we use the variation of the Lieber-DiCarli diet for ethanol exposure during prenatal period, and then the animals were challenged as either an adolescence or in adulthood with a large bolus dose of alcohol, and we looked at the alcohol-induced cytokine signature during acute intoxication, because this been really interested in this. This acute alcohol-induced, intoxication-related increase in interleukin-6 in particular, and its relationship to negative affect. So we have seen some moderate signs of sensitization in the prenatal alcohol-exposed animals in adults with a history of prenatal alcohol exposure. It seems like the adolescents may be developmentally protected against that. So we are in the process of preparing that right now. And I think you might actually get a very different answer to that question if you're looking at neuroimmune responses when the animals are off alcohol. Because the withdrawal-related cytokine signatures are quite different than what you get with during intoxication.
Okay, thanks.
It's Joanne. So that was really a wonderful presentation, and I think you're right, Terry. I think it's the period when you challenge, and it may be the type of challenge, whether it's an alcohol challenge or an immune challenge or a stress challenge, you may see differential effects through that, either upregulation or downregulation of the cytokine response. And we certainly have other outcome measures where the finding is not so much that the alcohol are hyper-responsive, but that they fail to respond the way the controls respond. So the controls may show an active response, say, in increased gene expression or in some other outcome measure, and the alcohol do not show a response. So I think getting hyper-responsiveness or dampened response or lack of appropriate response are all inappropriate responses and signal dysregulation in the system.
I agree 100%. And so that actually, I haven't responded to your email yet, Joanne, about the symposium, which I think is a great, it looks great. These are the data that we would present from my lab.
Wonderful. We'll talk offline. That's great.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Well, I'd just like to comment that the nature of this conversation right now and the symposium that Joanne and Terry are talking about, that sort of include Aaron Milligan and I forget who else that RSA is being proposed, is exactly the kind of conversation I was hoping for, because I see all this similar work, different models, similar issues, and the opportunity to move forward more quickly, I just think is is evident.
Well, John, yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I mean, I think this is a great idea, and I appreciate you putting it together. And I hope we can continue to interact in these types of ways, because I do think there are lots of commonalities in findings and using different models. And I think that this is just a natural way to go. And I think, like, the symposium that's being proposed by Joanne is a great one. So I'd like to encourage this for the future as well. And thanks.
The other opportunity that we have, as centers, is to try and bring together our faculty and trainees, at the RSA meeting. You know, we have historically, over the last few years, we've been hosting a sort of Friends of Binghamton kind of dinner get-together at one evening of RSA. I think it would be easy to adapt that in Minnesota coming up in June to include, trainees and faculty from the various centers so that we can try and spur some scientific conversation.
We could have a Friends of Alcohol meeting.
Yeah.
But, I think it's great, and I'll be happy to talk in the future, about trying to plan something where we can all get together at RSA.
That sounds great.
All righty. I hope everyone can stay on because we have other business we need to go through today. And Terry, again, thanks a lot. I appreciate you doing this.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
I hope everyone found that useful and informative.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, do you want to talk about the RSA symposium and then Joanne as well?
Sure.
So our concept for the RSA symposium is translational efforts from CFAST that can be scaled to practice. Ed is to, in the proposed symposium, lead off with a discussion of how to come to consensus on diagnosis and scale up diagnosis around the world if everybody's using a different system. Then Mike Suddy is going to talk about the potential utility of 2D and 3D imaging for diagnosis using machine learning and the approaches that we've all seen. Sarah Mattson is going to talk about her tablet-sized and increasingly refined decision tree to try to simplify the neurocognitive testing and allow it to be done at remote sites. The last one is going to be Christy Petrenko, who's going to talk about the development of her treatment app. So sort of going through revisions of abstracts and hope to get that submitted. The deadline is December 3rd.
And we appreciate you doing that. And, Joanne?
Right. So as John was saying, the whole cross-center, cross-consortium idea was raised at our face-to-face meeting, and it's a wonderful idea. And then Michael, in the course of putting together the CFAS symposium, had asked for input. And rather than just do kind of a summary of each center or the kind of thing that Terry just did, I thought one theme that I see obviously across several centers is the theme of immune function and inflammation. And it will be in the developmental alcohol exposure context, not FASD, which I had written in my email that I had sent out. So it took me a while to get it together, but I've just sent out an email, and the thought is that we can represent the NMARC, the New Mexico Center, with Erin and her really beautiful work on inflammation and spinal cord and pain with prenatal exposure, Terry's work on developmental alcohol exposure in adolescents and cytokines, that's just beautiful work. And then we kind of represent both CFAST and Kids Brain Health Network with our immune work in this lab. And two people from my group, one, Tammy Bodner, who's a postdoc being reappointed as research associate, to talk about our human project with CFAST. And then Charlize Reinecke, who's a senior research associate in the lab, to talk about animal models of alcohol, prenatal alcohol and early life abuse. And with an animal model, you can at least begin to pull out independent and interactive effects of early alcohol and early life abuse and its effects on outcomes, include particularly immune function. So that would be the four. I've asked, I would kind of organize it and do the introductions and moderate, and I've asked John Hannigan to be a discussant, given that it's really his baby, and I think it would be wonderful for him to be participating with this as well. So that's the thrust of it. I already heard a really enthusiastic response from Erin, who has already sent her material, and I just sent this out last night. And Terry will be part of it, and my group as well. So this is what we're thinking.
I think it's a great idea, and CFAS will be well represented by these two symposiums, as well as all the other papers, et cetera, that were given there. We are going to have a face-to-face meeting. All of us are going to be in Toronto, and we were having trouble with
Vancouver.
Vancouver, I'm sorry. We're having trouble with study section and everything else, but it's going to happen. And the organizers have made a special exception in allowing us to hold our meeting overlapping with their meeting in part. So we are going to be meeting on Friday, March 8th, or starting around 3:30. Similar to what we did in San Diego. We'll try to be done by around 7:30. But Friday, March 8th. So we're going to overlap in part with that meeting. And it would be great, though, if no one said anything about it so that other groups don't try to do the same thing. They're kind of making this a special deal for us because they like what we've done in the past. And when we explained the situation of couldn't have it the day before, we couldn't have it the day after, we came up with this idea, but they don't want to start a tradition of having overlapping meetings during their plenaries or their sessions. So if everyone could mark that on their calendar, that's when we're going to do it. Are there any problems with that we are unaware of? If anyone needs any meeting information or...
Say again when this is going to be, Ed?
March 8th.
That's
Friday.
Friday, yeah.
It's Friday during the FASD conference, which
right.
ends Saturday
and
around...
That conference begins on the 6th?
6th to the 9th, yes. I've got it up on the screen, too, hopefully.
And so... hopefully everyone will be able to attend, and then Saturday, when we finish on Friday night, then stay the night, and then Saturday, if you want to hear the ending of these meetings, is usually pretty good, and then so everyone will be able to get home on Saturday.
It was brought to my attention by the organizers as well, is that the lodging typically fills up, and so registration for the conference isn't happening yet, but you can book your lodging. So I've got that information up on the screen, and I also sent it in an email. I can resend it as a reminder.
That's probably a good idea, Jill. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't been there, it's an absolutely gorgeous spot. So,
if anybody has questions or issues or wants to talk to me about anything for the local scene that I can help you with, I'm happy to help. So just contact me.
Okay, any other questions about the meeting? Dale and Bill, you're going to have any problems getting there, or is we all good?
I think we're all good.
All right, the Central Repository Data Transfer Test. Jill, you want to, I know that Tatiana can't be on, and I don't believe Lee is on either.
Are you guys seeing a PDF now with the CFASD4 at the top?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Great. So they just wanted me to remind you that the test data files need to be uploaded by this upcoming Saturday. And if you're having any issues with that, into the IU box, to go ahead and contact Leah. One of the things that they did bring up to me that they'll be looking for is to make sure that the way that you explain the data is going to look in the data dictionary is how your data file actually looks. They said one of the things that comes up is sometimes people have a field like sex and they use female, F, M, whatever. They want you to pick one label only and stay consistent. So that was a little bit of the advice that I got from them, and they'll be getting back to each project with any issues that you have, but they want you to do a test file by the first. Does anyone have any questions that I can maybe field? I had a little discussion with Leah to maybe field some. Everyone's good? That's great.
All right, then if there are no questions about that, and I think some people have started to upload and get some feedback. Jill, about our tracking.
Now, can you guys see the tracking document?
Yeah.
Okay. So everyone was excellent about going on to the online shared Google Doc and updating their data. Everyone can access this at any point and click through the tabs to see how everyone's doing. The yellow numbers are what is updated each month. It looks like everyone had some progress this month. I can click through these as we go. Dr. Chambers is not on the call. Dr. Coles?
I'm on the call.
Yep. Oh, Tina, hi. Sorry, I didn't know you were on. So your data is up right now if you had any comments, or do you guys want me to click through these?
Nope. I can't see it, but I'll look separately.
So you see how they work, and everybody got their data in there. I think we have all the projects in, right?
Yeah, I just need to connect with Dr. Jones, but I'll do that.
Right. I'm here, Jill.
Hi.
I'll call you a little later.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Any questions on these and how they're supposed to be updated and when?
Hey, Ed. This is Bill here. I just want to say NIAAA really appreciates everyone's efforts in these Google Docs and helping us track the progress, and big thanks to Jill for getting it going.
She's been fantastic in doing this stuff. It's unbelievable. So thank you, Jill.
You're welcome. And in case any of you are really stuck on what you need to get that special person in your life for the holidays, I wanted to share with you that you can make your own 3D ornament now using an iPhone X and the app. Can you guys see the animation on this?
We can.
You haven't gotten me one yet.
I don't have an iPhone X, Ed. I can't do it.
Okay. Hey, is Mike on the phone or no? Study. Okay, he's not. So
wait a minute. Couldn't we do 3D photographs of people and send these little bobbleheads to Ken for diagnosis?
The gift that keeps giving.
All right, so while we're on this idea of the face and all that stuff, I'm going to show you something that we've been working on, and just for your feedback. So I got to share my screen. Is that what I do, Jill?
You can share your screen, or you can just share the application. You want me to come in there?
No, I'm good, I think. Let me know if
I see lips.
Can you see that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I did. I could, and then you clicked it away.
Oh, it went away.
No, yep. There it is.
All right. So, you know the lip filtrum guide, right? Five categories, and what I asked Mike Suddy and Gans Chocolingham to try to do was to make it so that it was on a continuous scale rather than on a like scale. And this is our first iteration of what we've been trying to do. And hopefully you can see that what happens is that literally you could take a subject and have them right in front of you. And this is available on an iPhone. And just move the slider across the thing. until the lip matches up with the subject right in front of you, and have a more continuous thing. So do you think that this would be useful in the diagnosis?
I think it's terrific. Does the philtrum move independently?
We're working on that now.
Okay. Right.
So what we need is some high-resolution photos of philtrums, all right, so that we
and then,
can morph them between the two.
And then is it the score at the upper left? Is that what you'd rate it as?
We're going to have it continuous. Right now there are 10 morphs involved. We can have up to 100 morphs.
Okay.
I think it's almost too much, 100 morphs.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to find somewhere and then send it out and ask the dysmorphologist where they would set the demarcation for, an FASD lip. Because, right now it's a 4 or a 5, but according to a paper by Susan, 37 or 38% of her subjects, control subjects, had lip fours. So obviously there's and in other papers she says it's normally distributed. So plastic surgeons have other scoring systems rather than just a 5-point scale. They're usually on a more 10-point scale. And we just want to make it continuous, so that you would come up with something like a 6.8. And then let the dysmorphologist decide and get some consensus on where a cutoff should be and utilize that. Since it's available on an iPhone, you can do it with the subject live right in front of you. This was done from a standard photo and just morphed between large and small. Or thin, and Mike is working from the data that was generated in CFAS from 400 subjects with using the lips from controls and the FASD and the deferred group. So they're the actual data that we have, and the only issue we're having there is with color shading right now. And once we get this technique up and running, we could do it for any racial or ethnic group we wanted to and kind of establish norms in that way. So, Ken, do you think this is useful?
Well, as you talk about it, it sounds like a great idea. There's absolutely no question that... there's a lot of issue going from 3 to 4. There are a lot of, basically people will call something a 4 one day and a 3 the next day. So the issue is that it's somewhere in between. So I think that there, on first blush, it sounds like a great idea, but I think that it really has to be worked out very, very carefully. For example, on FOSS, is it a straight-on view that you're doing, or are you doing a 45-degree angle?
Well, just like I said, this is just the first attempt.
Right.
And so it was a straight-on photo.
Yeah.
Of a single child who's then morphed between having a lip 1 and a lip 5.
Right. Well, I think that it sounds great. It sounds, if it can be worked out, it sounds like it would be a great thing.
This is Christy. I have a question.
Yeah.
I know I've heard some different folks talk about sort of the thinness of the lip versus sort of the Cupid's bow being flatter or more bent, and I'm wondering, in this case, it looks like it's just really focusing on thinness.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there were some thoughts about that or whether the CFAS data show any differences with the Cupid's bow or whether it's just thinness.
Well, that'll be interesting when we get Mike's rendition because they're the actual diagnosed subjects from Ken.
Right.
and we could compare them. Now, what we can also, what we've also talked about doing is once you have and you decided with the subject sitting there what the lip looks like, what's the closest one to it, that it would do the spiracy test that is used in the four-digit photographic tool. So actually measure the area of the lip, which is, you know, what the four-digit tool uses in its photographic analysis. So, you know, there's all types of things, the 45-degree angle. The philtrum, we didn't know whether to have it on the same image or a different image.
What, the lip?
Yeah.
The philtrum on the lip on the...
It has the capacity to manipulate on different dimensions, not just a single dimension.
Yeah.
This is Claire. You know, I think that the bow and the philtrum are essentially the same thing, so it seems to me they need to be co-occurring.
Well, we've looked at the correlation, and so far we have found, using CFAST data, that there's a correlation, or I think it was the CFAST data, it might have been the Canadian data, a correlation between the lip and the philtrum ratings.
Of course there is.
Like Claire is talking about something different, Ed. I think you're talking about using the thinness of the lip versus the presence or absence of a distinct Cupid's bow.
I am. I think they're both important, but I think that there's a relationship between the existence of the philtrum and this whole structure of that part of the lip and the Cupid's bow.
I agree.
And if you, I mean, you can't separate them meaningfully. So if you arbitrarily do so in photographs, it's not going to create a real thing.
Well, that would be the nice thing with Mike's data. They're not artificially created. They are the actual data that have been collected.
That would be a better thing. The other thing you should do is, if you really want to validate all of this stuff, you should start doing it in exposure samples. So now we're using samples of people that... in CFAST that we identified as FAS based on our understanding of these elements. But if you really wanted to validate it, you should take the faces of people who are exposed and see if these things actually do turn up regularly.
I'm not sure what...
Well, for instance, the Ukrainian sample, or my sample, or other samples in which we know what the exposure was.
Right.
Are we regularly seeing these patterns?
Well, that's what Mike's data will show us. I mean, they were created from those 3D photos.
No, it was created from 3D photos of people who were identified based on these features.
Right.
That's not the same thing as knowing the exposure and seeing whether the features actually turn up regularly.
All right, so that would be all the Ukraine kids.
Yeah.
So
that would validate these things for once and for all.
So, Ed,
yeah.
I would really like, I don't know how far along you are on this, but I would really like to get involved in this a little bit earlier rather than later. So if I could talk to you and whoever else is involved with this, I would really appreciate it.
This was Gantz and his 15-year-old daughter.
Okay. Well, I'd love to talk to Gantz and his 15-year-old daughter, particularly his 15-year-old daughter, as opposed to Gantz. But
Bailey Misha was the one who did this.
Yes. Right. So I would be thrilled to be involved with it. Is Gantz on the phone?
No.
Oh, okay.
And I wasn't going to bring this out for prime time yet, but I showed it to Bill Dunty, and we wanted to get some feedback. And
I think there are other things that you need to think about. For example, there are a lot of kids that have filtral ridges that go halfway from the vermilion border to the place where the columella hits the philtrum. And what to do, and they're smooth above, and they're good filtral ridges below. And I think that it's important to be thinking about things like that.
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to replace the 5 Likert scales. There's just too much confusion, as you pointed out. And that was just the initial purpose was, rather than use a Likert scale, which we know has problems, in Susan's own paper there seems to be discrepancies between what she finds and her controls. So to kind of replace that with something that was just a little bit more continuous, where you could actually see how...
I think it's great. I really do. I would get rid of... I would also get rid of 1 and 2. There's no point in having them for what we're doing.
So you have to define a control. You have to define an unexposed phase too.
Yeah, and I'd like to know if they were normally distributed in any population, because it doesn't appear from the data that they are.
They're not.
So that's just where we are.
Yeah,
the
I think it's great.
This is Sarah. The other thing that is, I think it's cool, and I think it's great that Ken wants to be involved. I'd be happy to help. But the other thing that is a good about this is that we can't use Susan's lip filtrum guide in any, you know, like if we want to add information about this in our decision tree app, but we can't, she won't let us use the lip filtrum guide in our app. So having something else would be great.
I just like the fact that, you know, you're not comparing it to five things. You're comparing it to an infinite number of things.
Yeah.
When you have the real subject right in front of you, if you're a physician and you don't feel comfortable making that decision about where the lip and the filtrum are, you can just slide across and say that's what it is. And then the dysmorphologist will have told you where the cutoff point is. So, you know, I think it has some value as an app. And I agree that I think we could do a lot of things to improve it. But something to show right away of what we're trying to make progress on for Dr. Kube and others at NIAAA. So we'll continue to work on it. Ken, I'll talk more about it with you.
Great.
I would appreciate it, though, if people didn't talk about this. All right, sure. Since we would like to keep it proprietary for right now.
Sure.
And we'll go from there. All right, so how do I unshare my screen, Jill?
I got it.
Thank you. Well,
hey, Ed, Dale and I have to get to another meeting.
Yeah.
Oh, I just want to interrupt before everyone hangs up and just remind everyone that the call next week, our next month is on the 19th because our regular fourth Wednesday would have interfered with winter break.
Okay.
One other thing. This is Claire. I would like to talk to Bill. Can I call you later? Because I have a question about what to do about prisoners who are turning up in the sample.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
The 19th.
One other announcement.
Yeah.
Hmm?
Bill.
Claire, sure, you can give me a call. One other announcement before we jump off is Phil May is giving the Mark Keller lecture tomorrow here at NIH. And just to let everyone know, and I was looking back at the previous lectures, and this will be the last four. This will be the third on prenatal alcohol exposure. So,
wow.
With Michael and Kathy Solik being the last two.
Okay.
Sorry, what was that?
I sent Phil a congratulatory email, so
okay.
I think it's quite an honor.
The question, right, Jill, did you say next month's meeting was the 19th?
December 19th.
Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, everybody. Thank you again, and I think it was a good call. So take care, and I hope everyone had a happy Thanksgiving. And talk to you all soon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.